Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to the Weight of Fatherhood podcast. I'm your host, Brian Phillips, and I'm joined today by Matt Bianco, who I'm calling a guest, even though Matt and I go way back. Matt is now CEO of the Searcy Institute. Congratulations. And also a well-known teacher, conference speaker. His real claim to fame, of course, is that Matt and I used to share an office at Searcy.
Good times.
Yep, good times, good times. And for the record, I started working from my home office. We didn't have a big falling out or anything, at least not that we're going to discuss on air. No, Matt has been a dear friend and a great influence in the world of classical education. And we've done several podcasts together in the past, normally about something related to teacher training or specific works of literature, cultural things. But Matt, thank you for joining me. This is a kind of a different sort of podcast, but I appreciate you joining me here during this first season of The Weight of Fatherhood. It's good to have you.
Well, being that I know everything about fatherhood, I figured it was perfect show for me to come on. So,
Yeah, absolutely. I thought we should just go ahead and call out the big guns while we're getting started, let people know the sorts of things they can expect to come. It's all downhill from after Matt's podcast. Now I asked you to do this episode because even though as I mentioned, you're with the Searcy Institute, people do know you as a teacher, as a speaker. But one of the things that people may not know about you is that you authored a book on fatherhood back in 2014, or it was published in 2014. I'm sure it was in the works well before then, but it's called Letters to My Sons. So, Matt, what inspired you to write that book?
Well, good question. Probably because there was so much wisdom in my head ready to explode that I just needed an outlet for it, and so I just, it was like I was intellectually constipated and I needed to get, that wisdom out. And so I wrote a book.
Was it wisdom or just voices in your head?
multiple voices just coming in from every direction. Couldn't control it. Honestly, it was my oldest son had graduated from high school and was taking a gap year. And so he had moved out of the house and he was going to live. Actually, the gap year program was in the same town where we lived, but he was going to live kind of across town in an apartment with roommates. And so he was gone, right? The oldest is out of the house. The next one's just a couple years behind him. And then the last one's a couple years behind him. And I think part of it was just like, I'm scared, right? Like, my firstborn, my eldest son has just left the house. And I don't know if I've done a good job. I don't know if I've told him everything I need to tell him. I don't know if I've showed him everything I need to show him. All of that stuff. And it just starts kind of coming at you. And I was like, well, I'm just going to write down everything I know. And then
this kind of desire to suddenly catch up on everything that flew by you. Right. Everyone knows this, every parent knows this, the time goes by so fast. It flies by. And it's such it's almost a cliche, right? But I'm sort of beginning to experience that. Our oldest is 13 now. We actually have a teenager. And I know you're past that as far as how old your kids are. But yeah, I'm starting to get a glimpse of that, and more and more that they're just like two of our four children are bigger than my wife now, which granted is very short, but still. So I think we all understand that feeling too. I mean, you've written other works, and you and I have even done some book projects together, the Tales of Wonder books and so on, and you've done other writing projects, but I imagine writing this, writing letters to my sons felt unique. It was probably a very different experience for you, right? So how different was it writing something so personal?
Yeah, it's interesting because, for other projects, like, you want to get it right. You want to say something that's right, but you don't ever want to write a book and then have the readers come back and say, what? That's completely wrong. That's not true. For any book, I think or even articles or essays or whatever, talks at conferences.
Right? And, yeah.
Yeah. But with this one, it's like, I'm kind of putting everything out there and kind of saying, like, this is how you should go about life. Mm. This is how you should interact with other people. And this is how you should understand, the ways that you'll interact with other people. And so there it's like, I really don't want to get it wrong. Like, I don't want to get it wrong in the sense of presenting it in a way that makes it easy to reject, but I also don't want to present it in a way that, like, the way that I present it is wrong in the sense that it's like, I just turned it into a bunch of, legalistic rules.
Right.
Trying to avoid wrongness at various angles because I want them to receive it as whatever little bit of wisdom was in those words, right? I want them to be able to get to that and not miss it because I did something wrong. So at that point, it definitely would have been the very first thing that I spent as much time as I did reviewing it, editing it, proofing it, paying somebody else to edit it, all of that. Yeah.
The nature of it too, I imagine it's really impossible when you're writing. Essentially, I guess if it fits a genre, it's almost like a bit of wisdom literature, right? That's the attempt. Whenever you write something like that, you know full well, even going in, this is never going to be perfect, right?
Right.
It can't be because we don't have perfect wisdom, but then knowing too that your children, your sons in particular, are the primary audience to this. I mean, that's a big weight. So I know that it's one thing to teach writing, to teach students or even adults how to write essays or different types of writing, but engaging in something like this, I think, is a different animal altogether. And the book, you included a lot of different letters covering some really important issues, and particularly important issues for young men, for your sons: adultery, sexual sin, temptation, family, relationships, and so on. Which of the letters was most difficult for you to write to your sons? And I told you we're not going to end this episode until I make you cry. So this is my first overt attempt. I'm kidding about that, of course. But what do you think was the hardest thing to actually give advice to your sons about?
Be
as personal as you want to be, man.
Yeah, right, right. So there's a couple that kind of vie for being the most difficult, but for different reasons. So the first one is just it's actually the introduction. Because in the introduction, I'm not even really talking to them as much as I'm talking to any other person who might have happened upon it, right? But in the writing of that introduction, I think my own childhood and the fact that I grew up with an absentee father, not absentee like abandonment, but absentee more like Odysseus, where he was just off working. And then it wasn't in a soldier or a sailor, but he was a truck driver. And so he was just gone all the time.
Right.
And realizing that I'm introducing a book in which I say things to my kids that I never had said to me. And I think there was a difficulty there, kind of with coming to terms with that or facing it, like admitting it to myself, maybe for the first time, that as much as I love my dad, and he passed away in 2009. So just a few years before I started working on the book, the reckoning that with that as much as I love him and he's gone now and I don't have this from him and I don't have a way to get it.
Yeah.
I think that in an odd way, the introduction was hard for me.
Sure.
There's a letter in there called Finding the Right Distance that was difficult because I think in that one, I perhaps use a personal example from my own failures, probably the most vividly in that letter more than in others. In others, it always tended to be more general, or the examples were positive. Or there are other people's examples, you know, but in that letter, I use myself as an example, a negative example. And that's hard, right? Because I'm admitting something to my sons about my own weakness and not wanting to give them permission to succumb to the same temptation because, well, Dad did. And
sure.
You know, he wasn't strong enough to overcome it. How am I going to be, or however they might excuse it in themselves, you know? So I don't want to do that, but I also wanted to be vulnerable and honest with them and trying to figure out like whether that's the right thing to do and then how to say it. And then am I going to regret it? And you know, all that stuff to come with it.
That's a balance, isn't it? So that's always a very tough balance to maintain because as fathers, as parents, we want to be honest with our kids. You know, I think one of the most dangerous things we can do is kind of project the idea that we're perfect, that we don't make mistakes. We need to be quick to confess, quick to apologize, quick to admit wrong, quick to make it right, you know, and model that for them while at the same time, we know that we do need to maintain a kind of moral authority. And that means that they also have to see that, you know, we're learning from our mistakes and not just kind of wallowing in them. And so that is sort of a fine line between how much do I share, you know, how much do they really need to know about,
right.
They need to know that their dad is fallen and imperfect and in need of confession. Do they need to know how much, you know? So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, and the idea too, that like to some extent, you know, we dads are examples to our children. And am I setting the example by appearing to be a good example, or am I setting the example by being what I actually am?
Right.
But then exemplifying the way I respond to those failures. And so, you know, there's on the one hand, like there's things you just never want to tell your kids.
Sure.
And probably, you know, depending on how far back they are, that's appropriate, right? Like they don't need to know every single thing. But when something happens in front of them or around them or something that they become privy to, then, you know, trying to deny those failures or hide those failures seems counterproductive because the better example there is, look, this is what repentance looks like when you do that. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So if, you talked about the most difficult ones to write, are there any that stood out to you as, you know, it could have been when you were writing it or once the book was complete where you would look back and say, that's the most important one. If they latch on to that one, that's probably the most important. And if so, you know, why?
When I wrote it, it was the chapter, the letter, Love is Liturgical. Hmm. In that letter, I'm trying to, and in the letter before it kind of sets it up, but I'm trying to think through with them what love is and that, you know, at their age, love is very emotional, right? They're smitten by, you know, the young lady in class or whatever, the girl at church or in, neighborhood or whatever. And I wanted to communicate that, you know, that's fine. Like that, those emotions, those feelings matter. They do something to us, but in the end, like that's, I don't feel that 25 years later with my wife, right? Like that's not, or if I do, that's not the thing that keeps me at her side. The thing that keeps me at her side is the life that we've lived together, the habits that we've created with each other, the everything, the culture of our home and our relationship, and the loyalty and the commitment that results from those activities or behaviors. The liturgy of our lives is my point there. And I wanted to push them past the emotional part of the feelings part of love, that feelings can come and go, feelings can go away, but it's those practices, those liturgies that can sustain us, that do sustain us past the fleeting emotions, and more importantly, that it's those liturgical practices in the home, in the family, in the relationship with the wife, with your wife, that can renew those feelings if they are lost.
Right.
That we can revive them. We can bring them back by, like, if I think in the letter I describe it as, you know, I give an example of a man going away on a work trip for two months or whatever, and then some of the practices and the habits and the rituals that he had with his wife get lost, and he starts perhaps creating those with somebody else that's on the work trip with him, and maybe starts finding that he has feelings for her, and then we can confuse those feelings with what love is, come back and think, well, I'm really in love. I fell out of love with you, and now I'm in love with this other woman. But the reality is that we can not easily, but we can recreate those. We can reinstitute those practices. We can end the practices with this alien woman, as it were, and reestablish them with the wife of our youth. And that itself can revive the feelings that we are longing for.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to communicate that. And so those two letters, that one letter in particular, and the one that sets it up, I think I felt were the most important. Mm-hmm. And when the lady that had edited the book for me before it went to press, I guess, she came to me after the book was written, or after she had gone through the whole book, and said that chapter was the most important to her. And she actually said, I think you could write an entire book on marriage just from that chapter.
Yeah,
I didn't, yeah, of course, but, but it was to her. Now, as I was
perfect time to launch it, if you got it for you. You heard it here first.
the announcement. I'm going to write a book on marriage. No, I'm probably not. When I was looking through it, though, in advance of this, I think there's more in that thankfulness letter, the last letter, or the last substantive letter, the one before the concluding letter. But
yeah.
I think thankfulness it probably ought to be more expanded and thought about in the letter, in the book, and emphasized a little bit more. But
yeah, well, that was actually the what I wanted to kind of follow up with there is, as I mentioned at the beginning, the book was published in 2014. So now that some time has passed, you know, both of your sons are out of college now. Your youngest is in college, but starting your junior year already. Is that right? That's unbelievable. Yeah. Other people's kids make you feel old too, right? But now that some time has passed, other than expanding a bit on thankfulness, is there anything you would change in those letters, or any new letters that you would add to the book now that you have a little bit more experience behind you?
There's probably a little bit of both. I think early in the book, I'm trying to talk to them about, you know, rules versus principles and timelessness versus timeliness. I guess kind of universals versus particulars. And I was actually just thinking the other day that there's a line from John Chrysostom where he says that if two people came to him and were seeking, you know, advice or counsel on the exact same sin, they both had committed the exact same sin and were going to him for counsel, he says that the response that he would give to each of them would be different because they're different people. And I'm expanding on my own thoughts now, but the idea that like even the punishment, as it were, or whatever, the way we respond to things, good or bad, reward or punishment, has to take into account the nature of the person that we're interacting with, even my own nature for myself or yours for you. And you know, maybe this is a little bit of like what Lewis talks about love languages, or somebody talks about love languages, I can't remember. And that, you know, there's certain things that motivate us or drive us and that we look for in love, you know, that even I guess thinking a little bit more about circumstances, the circumstances of the person, the circumstances of the event, not to relativize the behavior and say, well, oh, it was sin for this guy, but it's not for this other guy. That's not what I mean at all. But taking circumstances into account, like, what does it mean that this person fell into this sin? And what does it mean that this other person fell into this sin? And you know, does one person need, but because of his own circumstances, his own nature, his own person, need something harsher or less harsh based on that? So I guess I'd want to talk a little bit more about the role of circumstances with respect to the principles, or with respect to the application of the principles that are in the book. And I think I do talk about it, but I probably want to develop that a little bit further. Yeah. As far as new letters, I think that the new letter that I would want to write most, or letters that I would want to write most, is just stuff that I've learned about the parts of the soul and or the kinds of desires that we have, like the desires of the appetite, the passions, the emotions, and then the intellectual desires and spiritual desires, and help us to helping them, my sons or the readers of the book, I guess, to see how those desires are competing with each other for control of the person, and that there are ways that we can train those desires to be governed properly. And mm-hmm. I probably want to expand on that more, right? Because most of the letters in the book are about, you know, the behaviors that we engage in, the human activity we engage in because of those desires. And then how do we kind of regulate the external actions? But it seems like there's a way to think about how do I regulate the internal actions so that those desires aren't as controlling, I guess.
Yeah. So how making men with chests, right? Yeah.
Yes.
The tripartite soul that Plato describes and Lewis commented on. And it's very true. How to keep the appetites of the belly and the appetites of the mind in check through the chest, right? The courage and strength. Yeah. Well, what did you learn about yourself as you wrote this book? What did you learn about fatherhood? Does anything stand out to you as being, because I think most of us know if you've done any writing or speaking or giving advice to people, one of the things that happens, whether you mean it to or not, is that you end up learning something that you didn't know before, either about the subject, topic, or most frighteningly about yourself in the process, right? But how did writing the book affect you?
I think there were times when, this is kind of dumb, but I think there were times when I thought, that's really good. Like, I'm smarter than I even realized, right?
Right, right.
That's a really good point, Matt. So there were these times when I thought, wow, I'm wiser perhaps than I thought I was. And then there were other times where I'm like, what the heck are you talking about, dude? Yeah. Like, you're an idiot. So there was this like roller coaster of impressing myself and depressing myself simultaneously. Like, which one letter after the other, one paragraph after another.
Yeah, sometimes in the same chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of surprised me. And then and thinking about, you know, my own journey, because it forces me to think about my own journey, right? Like I mentioned earlier, you know, the idea that, you know, having to reckon with the fact that I didn't have a father who did this with me,
right.
That I had to kind of figure it out for myself, which is not really true, because I figured it out by looking to other people, right? Looking at other examples, but doing, you know, having to do that and not having the example kind of thrust before me by the presence of my father. And then from there, going through my own life of, you know, when I converted to Christianity, I mean, when I was saved, my version of Christianity, I think as a young convert, was very rules oriented. Mm-hmm. This is what I have to do to be a Christian. And then my own kind of growing from the rigid application of the rules to kind of understanding the purpose behind them and the telos, as it were, you know, the principles behind it all, and, you know, understanding that these rules make sense. They're not rules just so we have something to follow. They rules because they make sense, right? An image, the fact that one is an image of God requires certain ways of interacting with other images of God. And to do something to an image of God is to do something to God, right? Like when the flood happens and then there's the law is given for murder and the death penalty are instituted. The death penalty is instituted. God says to Noah that, or God says in that passage that, you know, because he killed the image of God, it was an attack on God. So learning to think from it, to think about it myself from the perspective of rules to the perspective of it making sense in light of what we really are and what God really is. And then trying to put that on paper for them, for others to go beyond, you know, wooden regulations to understanding it. That required me to kind of examine that path, that movement in my own life, my own way of thinking, and then putting it there. What did I learn about fatherhood? I mean, I learned that it's stinking hard and that it's important and that most of us have no idea what we're doing. But you know what I think I also learned was, like, in a weird way, I don't think the book was needed. Like I needed it, and maybe someday they will need it, but it's not like my son, like I published it, gave him a copy with a little inscription in the front, you know?
Yeah.
And then he went to bed that night, read the book, and then came out a holier and wiser person than what he already was. It didn't do anything like that. Like,
that's not how that works.
That's not how it works. And the reality is, like, whatever I was feeling about my failures or my, what I didn't live up to as a father for each of them at that point, I don't know that I was right. Like they got what they got and they were already, they had already moved or were moving into manhood and independence. And there was nothing that I could say or do to stop that. There was nothing that I was going to write to rectify it. I think the book probably had very little impact on my children at that point.
Yeah.
And I think its importance will probably be to them when they're in this place.
Yeah. When they're the age that you were when you were writing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's when it'll mean something to them. That's when it'll be the most important to them. Or, you know, when I pass away, then...
you heard it here, folks. Then, no.
you know, then it'll be meaningful then probably, you know, cause yeah. It'll be the thing, something they have to remember me by, but
yeah.
You know, there's this passage in Charlotte Mason where she talks about how, our children become independent whether we prepare them for it or not.
Yeah.
And that you can't slow that down. You can't stop it. You can't hold them back. Like, either you release them into the world as a bunch of unprepared, ill-prepared ignoramuses, or you prepare them. But either way, they get released into the world. You cannot stop that. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. That's not a direct quotation from Charlotte Mason.
Just that would have been really impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like, I think that's something that I've learned kind of after the fact. Like, I think there was a part of me that thought, by writing the book, I'm going to give this to them, and then there, it's just going to be like a brain dump. Like, I'm just going to brain dump through the pages of the book into their minds, and then they'll know everything that they needed to know to be adults.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is they already knew. Like, they'd lived with me for 18 years, 19 years, 17, whatever it was at the point, you know. And they'd already seen whatever examples that I had provided for them. They'd already heard the way I interacted, and they'd seen and heard the way I interacted with other people, their mothers, them, their siblings, people at church, cousins, work, whatever. They'd seen all that. They knew.
Well, it's an important reminder. It's something that we talk about a lot in the realm of the classroom. But I think for classical educators, we have the tendency to sometimes want to book everything, you know, like every problem finds its solution in a book. Right. And we talk about it when we talk about pedagogy, we learn by imitation, you know, mimetic teaching, it's important to embody these things and so on. But that sounds so, kind of theoretical. But when it really comes down to it, what we're talking about is incarnation, right? And the fact that your sons, my sons, you know, are all of our children, the people around us, our friends, our family members, they're going to learn through human interaction. They're going to learn by what they see us do. And I think that's a very important realization. That's not to say that the book is not important. And I think, as you said, it probably didn't have the kind of impact at the time, you know, the immediate effect that you would have dreamed that it could have had. Right.
Right.
But in the long run, the book can be a part of that, but it's really going to be a part of it, a part of their development as men, you know, probably, I think you might be right. I mean, who knows, but we can't really peer into their souls when they were teenagers or, you know, when they're adults or whatever, but it can be a part of it, but their development of men as men is really going to come through what they've seen from you. Far more powerfully than the words of the book, and then what they've seen from you as their father is going to be echoed, you know, and maybe magnified when they read it, you know, that, ah, that's what he was doing, you know, that that's what he was going for. I see. Yeah.
That, you know, Seneca has a line where he talks about the idea that examples are the most efficient, best way to teach, and that precepts are a longer way to teach. And of course, I think he's saying, he's kind of taken the two of setting them beside each other, right? Examples or incarnational, you know, ideas, and then the precepts, the book, the words, right? And he's saying that the examples, the incarnational way, is the most efficient way to teach, the most effective way to teach, and precepts are the long, slow path. But from the teacher's perspective, like, that's from the student's perspective, right? Like, they learn more effectively from examples than they do from precepts. But from the teacher's perspective, we think we can get it to them faster by giving them the precepts, right? And that can be a distraction, I think, for us, right? That, and maybe even an excuse, like, I don't have to lead by example.
Yeah.
My mom used to say, when I was a kid, do as I say, not as I do.
Right.
Like, in a way, she was saying, listen to my precepts, don't watch my examples, right? Don't look at my examples.
Yeah.
And it always cracked me up, especially now as an adult. But she knew that we learn by example rather than by word, and was trying to like tell me not to do that because the words were better than the examples. So I don't, you know, maybe the book will be great because this, my kids will see, hopefully, God, please, that I did live out these principles, you know, and that these precepts are reinforcing the examples that they got. But you know, it's more important for us to just love our kids and you know, guide them in our everyday behaviors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking time out to join me for this episode today. Again, the book is called Letters to My Sons, A Humane Vision for Human Relationships by M.G. Bianco is the name on the title. His name's Matt, but you can call him M.G. from now on.
It's more like, you know, C.S. Lewis. And
right.
I didn't have two middle names, so I couldn't go J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, so.
Well.
My daughter makes fun of me because on the back it says, there's a little yellow... the book cover is supposed to look like a desk, and on the back there's a little yellow sticky note, and it says, is he a modern day C.S. Lewis? No, but he really enjoys reading him. My daughter makes fun of me for that all the time.
Well, hey, at least she read it. The back cover anyway.
it's what's funny is that of people like of teenagers, most of the teenagers that have told me they've read this book are her friends.
Oh, wow.
Kind of interesting. Like, my daughter somehow has, I don't know. I mean, I don't think she's going, like, she's not my agent, right? My publicist. She's not going around, like, telling people about the book. But for some reason, multiple friends of hers have purchased the book, read the book, told me about it.
Well, I imagine they're probably... a good number of moms that tune into this podcast too. I think it's that women are just more thoughtful than we are.
That's probably
and if any of the dads out there are offended, I'd be like, just think about it for 2 seconds. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Come on. Yeah.
This is not a hard admission.
No. we need to go back to that whole thing about confession and honesty. Right.
Right.
Well, thanks again for joining me today for this episode. I really enjoyed talking about Matt Bianco's book, Letters to My Sons, and it brought up a lot of important issues for us as dads. And I want to just take a moment to make some particular application and kind of highlight the things that I think we really need to take with us from this episode. One of the things that we discussed was the importance of honesty, and we don't need to pretend to be perfect as fathers. Our children don't need us to be perfect, don't expect us to be perfect, and don't think of us as perfect. They live with us, so they know better. But it is important that we show a kind of spiritual honesty. We're not talking about revealing every failure that we've ever had, but when we mess up in front of our kids, when they know it, when we lose our temper, we respond incorrectly, we need to model the gospel for them. And that means that we need to confess it. It means that we need to admit that we have done wrong, that we've sinned, and we need to ask their forgiveness. And in modeling the gospel for them, modeling the need for confession, the need to seek forgiveness and restitution, all of those things are very important for us as dads. It's also important that we remember our role in trying to hand down and pass on wisdom to our children. That's not done through necessarily, as Matt even said, through writing a book to your children. In fact, that might be one of the least effective ways, even though Matt did a great job and it was helpful for him. And in the long run, I think will be helpful for his sons. But we pass on wisdom to our children through our day in, day out life with them. We want to model what it looks like to try to follow and obey the Lord and to try to make wise decisions. So wisdom is, I guess to put a simple definition with it, is the ability to live life skillfully. And so we need to try to model that and teach that to our children. And so I want to leave you with one question. Like Matt, I too did not have a great relationship with my biological father either.
I shouldn't say Matt didn't have a great relationship. He mentioned that there was some physical distance because of his dad's work and so on. And I bet that among those of you listening, there are many, many out there who would say, yeah, that's me too. So a lot of us are in, we are sort of the first generation trying to hand down some of this kind of godly wisdom and modeling to our children. And we're having to do it not based on necessarily what we saw or gained from our relationship with our fathers, but we're trying to do this for our children for the first time. And so I want to leave this question with you. What can you do to hand down to your children what you did not receive yourselves? All right. Give that some thought. And I think that as we contemplate that and as we meditate on these things, the Lord will use these conversations and these questions to make us better parents, better fathers, better people, and better followers of Him. So again, thanks for joining me. Hope you all have a wonderful day and tune in next time to the Weight of Fatherhood podcast. I'm your host, Brian Phillips, for my guest, Matt Bianco, today, signing off.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.